Yeah, because I can't listen. It's probably going to be a very boring episode for people to listen to because I don't say very much because I can't hear two things at once.
That's all right. Maybe I will cut this bit out and put it at the beginning. Welcome, everyone. This is another podcast with a commentary. Christian always likes it when we use commentary with a K, because I don't know if you're aware of this, but the podcast as well has a K rather than a C. Sorry, I'm talking to Magnus here, not you, listener, who probably is aware of this.
James and Magnus do a podcast.
There we go. That should be the jingle, but that's sung with a podcast with a K rather than a C. Yeah. So, Magnus, if Gandalf came to you with the ring to rule them all, what would be your game?
Interesting question. You're not allowed to wear it. You're not allowed to do anything with it. You just got to keep it and hope that it doesn't consume your soul. I mean, it does turn you invisible, and that's very, very handy.
I know you, Magnus, and I know that you like to hoard things anyway. So
yeah, I do like to hoard things. I'd probably put it in a lead-lined box or something.
Because when you want to go invisible, you just go underneath your blankets.
Yeah. Or just leave abruptly without telling anyone.
That's a good way of being invisible.
The Magnus goodbye.
It's what we call in the trade post-visibility. It's a good way to live. Sorry, everyone. Welcome to this. I now feel like we've... in part disrespected one of the reasons that we're doing this podcast, and actually I'm going to disrespect it even further, because that is not the reason we're doing this podcast. If those have listened to the previous podcast where we talked about the most recent Doctor Who episodes, well, the first two of the new series, we had a little bit at the end, we were talking, and see, now Magnus is trying to distract me because they are on my screen and they have a ring, which is very shiny and rather cool. Consider me suitably distracted. Well done.
It's Galadriel's ring.
Oh, nice. What was the name of the necklace? That was...
Isn't it just the Evenstar?
It is Evenstar. Yeah, absolutely. Well done. You're not picking the Evenstar. You've got the Evenstar. Well, I never... Yeah, Magnus has the Evenstar as well, so... You know, I'm rereading actually Lord of the Rings, and I'm on the bit just before they're leaving the Shire, and they come off road, and they're in the brambles, and they see one of the horses and riders in the distance, and I'm kind of feeling that the podcast right now is next to Frodo in those marshes, totally off the road, totally off the path,
in the weeds. I haven't been rereading them, but I have been listening to them on audio. And I'm on the Two Towers now, and it's just after the Ents have attacked Isengard. Didn't really. I feel like the film undersells how cool the Ents are, which is very cool and angry.
Yeah, I remember when I first read it, I found the Ents quite hard to picture in my head because they seemed quite fantastical and out there. And then when I saw them visualised, I was a bit like, oh, okay. Are we safe? Has the rider gone? Let's assume he has, and we can come out of the brambles and head back to the path. The last podcast we did, we sort of mentioned the beginning of Doctor Who, which you weren't particularly aware of.
Mm.
And so I think we said at the time, we said after, didn't we, that maybe it'd be good if we did a commentary on the first episode and just see how you found it, we'd talk through it. And then we were planning to do that either this week or next week, but as people will be aware who listen to this podcast, William Russell, who played Ian Chesterton in the was one of the first companions, or one of the, or the first companion in some respects, passed away today, being Tuesday the 4th, I believe, or yesterday, age 99. And so it seemed a perfect fit. I mean, I never knew William Russell. I may have a signed photo of him that was given to me at Christmas once, sitting by my bed, but
a little shrine.
I tell you, Magnus, I actually have always really liked this character. This character has always really appealed to me. There's a certain sort of sense of eternal masculinity, which I find comforting. It's a sort of sense of warmth, but sternness and sort of a courage, which I, of course, never would have. So
James's daddy issues raising their head yet again.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Every moment of every day. So we thought, yes, we would watch Unearthly Child. So the thing here is we will be talking, obviously, through this. You do not have to watch it. If you have it, do watch it along with us. It's not available on iPlayer for reasons last year were made quite readily part of the discourse that there have been issues with actually the rights. So it's not an iPlayer. But I'm sure most of you have the DVDs. So we're gonna start it running. So, I mean, again, why I thought this was interesting is that you've not seen this. You don't know much about the first episode, do you, apart from kind of what we talked about last week?
Yeah, I don't know anything. Also, I forgot that it was going to be in black and white.
Yeah, 1963. Doctor Who doesn't hit colour till 1970. You've got 7 years to go yet.
Interesting. Just like my childhood.
Black and white?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting. Right, so...
are we going to have to count down?
3, 2, 1. This allows everyone else to do the same.
The theme tune!
It opens on the theme tune.
Nice.
So this would have been the very first shot of Doctor Who on Saturday evening, November the 23rd, 1963. And what's interesting, with as you watch this, is nice to sort of make you aware of ahead of time. I can't think of the word for that. There's a word for it. I couldn't think of it.
Preempt?
It wasn't preempt, but we'll go with that. This whole story is studio bound, and the way it was done at the time is that it's done fairly live recorded, not live televised. So there are very minimal transitions. So they have all the sets in the studio set up, and they will sort of, the cameras will move between setups, and it's all sort of planned that way. So it's all very, very much an organic live experience, even though there are a couple of breaks. And you can see in the story where there is a break. There's certainly one break, which is really obvious. So this is how it would open up. So, you know, the first companion, I suppose you would say you see, is the police box. And I'm sure you'd like to know that the scale of the police box is slightly smaller than a metropolitan one, so it could fit in the studio. So Coal Hill School, which has now had a long legacy. We are meant to be in London. This is London. This school makes a reappearance a few times in Doctor Who history. Colin Baker, Revelation of the Dark. Attack of the Cybermen, it appears. Remembrance of the Daleks for Sylvester McCoy. And then later on, it appears in the new series and then in the spin-off series, which... called Class. Did you ever see any of Class? Very few people did.
No, I don't think so.
It came out at the back end of the Capaldi era. It lasted a season, but it was set at this school in the contemporary days. So these are our two essentially leads at this point. They kind of lead the narrative. Ian Chesterton, William Russell, who is just passed away, and Barbara Wright. One of them is a villainous scientist, and the other is an acceptable historian. Arts and science combined into one pairing.
Very dangerous.
Very, very dangerous indeed. But what I like about these characters is they do have very much their own motivations through this. There's none of the... coming along for the ride. It's they have their own drives and engagements.
Very.
So how does this seem to you? So, I mean, does it feel very old?
It does feel very old. It's the accents mostly.
Everything is very English at this point.
A very specific kind of English.
No, Magnus, at this point of history, There were no other accents. I know this by watching television at the time. Everyone was distinctly English.
We know this because the school is called Coal Hill, but it's not in Wales.
No, it's in London. It's a London school. They don't even sound London. I think that's kind of the fun thing. I mean, if you didn't know it's in London, there'd be no reason for you to know where this is really set based on the accents.
Well, we know that it's based in England, which represents everything.
It does at this point, certainly, and certainly for Doctor Who. So what is interesting, you can find, and it's on the DVD as well, there was a pilot. Well, what we would call a pilot. It was produced and shot and not considered up to standard, so they had to redo it. So there is another version which is slightly different to this episode out there.
What is happening in this scene?
She's listening to music.
On what? This is
a transistor radio, I assume it's called. The music she's listening to in the Devil's Chord that we watched the other week, there is a billboard with the same name of the band on that.
Oh, okay.
As a connection. Because he does mention in that story, doesn't he, that it's somewhere across the city is where he would be.
Yeah. So they're suspicious because she's really great at science and also history, but...
Yes. I mean, wouldn't you be suspicious of any student who was extremely good
at
what they do?
I'm suspicious of most students.
And most people. I mean, I am suspicious of them as well. But yes, at the moment, they are suspicious.
Be careful, Susan. It's going to be foggy tonight.
And that's the sort of things you had to worry about in 1963.
That's be careful, Susan. There's been a lot of stabbings recently outside of the school.
It's a different era.
Why are they at school so late?
I think they're doing work at the end of school and she's still there because she's very enthusiastic.
French Revolution.
So the actors will have moved over to the set with the car, got into the car in that. That's how it was working.
That's cool.
So it's all very closely clustered together in this studio. Unless there was a break there, I can't remember. But that's kind of how it would work. There's quite a lot of characterizations in this, which you get to see in today's sort of episodes as well. So I'm not saying this is superior for it. But I think Doctor Who does get to a point where it starts becoming a little more formulaic. And you don't have this sort of process until more contemporary television. So these bits would have been pre-records, I think. Well, no, I think she did these bits and they obviously had pre-records of Ian's voice over the top. So it was all very much done in a sort of very live sense. So, of course, that meant they had to hit their marks. They had to get their lines right. And there would be times where if they wanted to do a retake, then there would be occasions where they would deliberately fluff their lines. And drop a swear word in there or something which would force a retake rather than go. Because if they just fluffed it, they could just go, well, we'll just keep it and just move on, which you would see in these early Doctor Whos. There's a point where William Hartnell sort of says, we would have been destroyed. We'd have been nothing more but cinders in Spain. And they left it in because it was just not worth economy. But if he had sort of said, oh, fuck that, they'd have had to then record it. So
fuck that. And also, fuck Spain.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether he wanted to fuck Spain. He was actually referring to space, and that was the flub. so to speak. Yeah, it was wasn't the line, I think, was, well, he's speaking to Ian and Barbara, and he says they could wind up, the two of them could wind up, if they weren't careful, as cinders floating around in Spain rather than space. And that, I think, is in the chase. They left that in, which has become one of the many what fans call Hartnellisms, of where he's fluffed lines. But yes, if they deliberately, as actors, swore, then that fluff couldn't stay in.
Hello, Christian here. I'm just interrupting this podcast to let you know that we have relaunched our Patreon. There are three options that you can choose from to support Casterbus. We have a £1 option, a £4 option, and an £8.50 option. These are all monthly, and the £4 and £8.50 option both come with a 7-day free trial, which I think is quite a great option to take. You can find out more at patreon.com/Casterbus. We'd really appreciate it if you could support this and help us in our ambition of creating more material for you, podcasts, reading materials, and possibly more. But if you can't support us on Patreon, it's fine. But it would be great if you could leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Now, it's back to the discussion.
She is 15. She might be meeting a boy.
Yes.
In the junkyard. At yes. night, where she lives.
Yes.
She's 15. She's basically an adult. She's got every right to live alone in a junkyard if that's what she wants to do.
60s, you can do things like that.
Yeah, they don't make junkyards like they used to.
And there was no knives, so no stabbings, so you were safe to live in the junkyards. You know, anyone did try to stab you, they'd have to obviously accost you first with a very British response. There could be no regionalities. There would have to be a certain amount of decorum, a certain etiquette, which would perhaps allow
a little bit of parley. And you'd almost certainly die of tetanus.
Yes. So this is the fabled junkyard. Again, the thing I always kind of like about these black and white ones, if any of these were in colour, you'd see through the set so quickly. Yeah. But it flattens it and allows it to sort of live in its own sort of mysterious world.
Like the way it was intended at the time. Why are the lights not on? That's my question.
I think it's, I never really understood this at the time, but I think it's an open top junkyard. My brain was like, it was like a junk house and there was a ceiling to it.
Like a warehouse.
Yeah, like a warehouse, but it's not. It's an open top junkyard.
I mean, can Susan see in the dark?
Who can say? I mean, I suppose technically we would say no, but she is alien. Not even yet a Time Lord, because that doesn't come until later either. They are just two aliens from another time and place.
How ubiquitous are police boxes at this time?
I think they were fairly common still. They were losing use. Well, I'm sure people older than me can correct me if they could be bothered. I don't think walkie-talkies came in quite yet. And that's what killed the police box and its value. So I would sort of say they were still fairly prolific. I think the phase-out was late 60s, 70s. But certainly you wouldn't find one in a junkyard, because that would be pointless. And given this design were made primarily out of concrete with teal doors, it wouldn't be easy to lift one in there either. But yeah, so Again, that's what's kind of fascinating about watching these early ones is this dialogue is like theatre.
Mm.
It was theatre in some ways, from an acting point of view. And if you are an actor who loved the stage, performing in television like this, it's a far closer experience. And I suppose some of that craft is enjoyable to watch when you watch it now from the future. What are your first impressions of this white-haired git?
You're cool.
He's very different in these early ones, which is kind of some of the magic of how it starts. Because this is the first episode, technically, of a four-part story, while the other three parts don't really connect to this first episode. So you don't really need to watch them. But in that in particular, in the stories following, the Dalek story following, he's very much not the Doctor that we get to know later on. Mm. And in a sense, the sense of morality and the sense of kindness and even the sense of heroism, that's the word, thank you, come from Ian and Barbara.
And that's these two?
Yeah.
Hmm.
They kind of lead the story. They're not so much the bridge for the audience, well, they are to a degree. But they are kind of the push behind the adventure, while the Doctor is kind of almost a reluctant character. Mm. I mean, in an episode coming up, his solution to a fooled attacker is to, as I recall anyway, is to find a large rock. And then Annie's persuaded not to use it. Because at this point, he's a very protective character, protective of this Susan.
Hmm.
So here we have a cut coming up. There we go.
It's bigger on the inside. When did Star Trek come out?
66.
So after this?
Yes. I mean, in so many ways. But obviously there was sci-fi before this, but it was very much a front runner in where sci-fi was, especially British sci-fi, where there wasn't really much. There was Quatermass. I mean, my mum's always said that she remembers watching this for the very first time when she was a kid. And she said it just blew her mind in the same ways that the Beatles blew her mind in terms of the sound. This was just so against anything she'd seen.
What's this interesting part here? Is this a model of a church?
I don't know.
I'm always intrigued by like the inside of the TARDIS because it, in the ones that I've grown up watching, it's very stark and it's just the middle control bit and then like blank walkways or there never seems to be much stuff in it.
No.
Which always confused me. Where is the stuff? Where do you sleep? Where do you pee? Leave the TARDIS constantly?
They don't ever cover the issue of peeing, as far as I'm aware. But so far as where you live, they do cover this in one of the next stories coming up here. But these very early Doctor Who's, I think it's not until about 76, getting my head right, around about 1976, until there's actually this notion that it's like a sprawling forever-like inside.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that point, you get a sort of sense of this control room and maybe some rooms outside it. But that's it.
Oh, so she comes up with TARDIS.
Yes. Which, of course, as history moves on, it perhaps is suggested that Time Lords use the name TARDIS, and it seems to be far more in the lexicon. But at this point, the suggestion is she came up with a name and he perhaps even built it.
He built it?
Yes.
Interesting.
There's a lot, I can't remember if it's actually in the show, if it's in the pilot, which suggests he's built the machine. But
tolerate this century.
He ends up liking to tolerate this century quite a lot. Well, eek, last century and this century. He has a lot of tolerance. And again, it's a fascinating design for time as well. Not just the notion of it being bigger on the inside, but the design of the inside. And over the next few years, the scale of it gets smaller. At this point, it's actually quite a big set, as you can see, with several walls. But it gets smaller and smaller. And by the end of the 60s, it's barely two walls. And they're slightly busted, and the main console section. But what I always quite liked about the style of design being like this is it almost suggests that this is a stolen ship from a race that is probably quite dull and boring. And he seems as out of place in it as he does outside. It sort of suggests again that. And here it looks like he's peppered a few things around the place, a chair or two and a clock.
But he just said that they're both from the same planet that they're cut off from.
Yeah, but there was no other idea at this point beyond that. The pilot suggests it's a planet in the far, far future, I think. And that was removed when they re-recorded it.
He's looking very mischievous.
Mm.
He's a lot more almost like a wizard.
Yes.
In this. Kind of like Gandalf.
You do expect him to perhaps have the ring.
Or he's just being mysterious and mischievous, just like Gandalf.
Yeah, he's a very different character at this point. And the story sort of suggests that these two perhaps catalyze him into the more heroic fighting for the little man personality that has sort of embedded itself in the show. But at this point, his focus is purely on Susan. And they carry this out. As I say, this story is technically four episodes. The Dalek story after that, seven episodes. And then there's a two-episode story, which was a sort of fill-in. It's only at that point do they start finding their dynamic.
The noise! The TARDIS noise!
That is the TARDIS noise. Again,
it must have been very exciting to see this set in the 60s on TV.
Yeah.
But it's very cool.
I mean, the effects in it like the effects of the time vortex and everything are pretty cool. The sound is a really interesting soundscape, totally alien to what you'd have otherwise heard. A show made for children by the drama department rather than the children's television department.
Mm.
If memory serves. I always love in science fiction how the first time something happens, it seems to go on forever. And then after that, it's like, oh, we're not doing that each time.
Well, we don't have, they don't have to explain it to you after the first time.
But I guess also in those early ones, it's a bit like how it was in a new series, where it's quite a rough ride.
Time has become all wibbly wobbly.
He just knows how to use a ship better now.
Mm.
In fact, he kind of gets to use a ship better from this point on. You don't really see them rocking and rolling after this until Christopher Eccleston appears. Also worth noting at this point, no materialization yet.
Oh, where have they gone?
I love the jaunty angle of the police box.
Is that a Gorn?
That would have been great if it was a Gorn, because anything with Gorns in is great. But yeah, so that would have been your first episode. That would have been the first experience of the show. I think it's a great little first episode. I mean, it has what, essentially, like I said, three sets. You know, it has the inside of the school, it has the outside of the yard with the car, and inside the police box.
Special effects by the visual effects department of the BBC.
The BBC, yes. I mean, it's incredible that that show, that one story, catalysed, you know, 60 years worth of this concept. And those people involved in it at the time, like Ian Chesterton, William Russell, no idea that it was going to, that it would, you know, perpetuate as it did.
So how long does this, how long?
How long does what?
How long this doctor?
Oh, this doctor, how long? Till 1966. He does 3 years and then his health is failing him, the actor. But yeah, so he is recast in 1966. Patrick Troughton takes the role. It's never said he regenerates at that time. There's even a suggestion it could be even rejuvenation. Troughton is just...
Well, he got Botox.
A younger version of Hartnell.
What, so nobody mentions it in the story?
They mention it, but I don't... I mean, it's one of those missing episodes, but from what I recall from the audio track, I mean, when he regenerates in that first one, he's got a brand new outfit. He steps up and he's... Patrick Troughton with a different outfit on, a bit like they did with Jodie Whittaker to David Tennant Mark II. And I, to be honest, I cannot remember. I think he says his body's wearing out, I think, is the kind of the line.
Mm.
And he is renewed in some form or another. But this idea of it being like a cellular regeneration, that this is an ongoing thing that they can do multiple times, if not forever, is not really nailed down until a lot later.
Yeah,
so,
it's interesting seeing it so unformed.
Mm.
Like it just exists in and of itself. Like it's like obviously the beginning of the story, but it's just kind of potential and possibility and a somewhat mysterious, basically space wizard, and their space apprentice and two hapless humans.
But I think it's why I've always liked it when they have TARDIS groups where it's more than just him and a companion. Because I think if you do it right, it could be really interesting. And I think these two have a really interesting dynamic which stays throughout their tenure. I think Ian and Barbara are just really interesting to watch. I mean, William Russell had been Sir Lancelot. I think he'd been lead in a TV show for a while. So he was kind of a big thing.
Mm.
But yeah, so that's the first one. You don't really get a sense of them as a team in that first one, but I think, as you say, it's interesting just to see proto-Doctor Who.
Proto-Doctor Who, yeah. I'm surprised that it's not on iPlayer. So who owns the rights then?
You could do a Google on this, because I think it was the issue was quite visible last year, and it's been a an ongoing thing, but I believe Anthony Coburn's estate had issues over the story, which is why I think it was left off iPlayer. It's the only one that's not on iPlayer.
But doesn't that mean just no one sees it then?
Yeah, I've not really looked into that.
So what's the point in that?
You need limits sometimes on your nerdiness, where you go, it's a step too far. I've got other things I need to do. And I didn't really follow the... Christian would probably know this far better than I, and most of the listeners would probably be far aware more of the Coburn drama far more than I. It was...
Maybe they can write in and tell
Twitter
us.
Was, yeah. Well, yeah, please do. Or tell us just to go and Google it, because probably should.
I'm going to be honest. I'm not going to Google it. I'd rather receive the information via pigeon.
I kind
of like
that.
And it feels like I've earned it, and that the information itself was useful and interesting. If I read it on Google, I'm going to forget within approximately 5 seconds.
Yeah, and I kind of like the listener being renamed as the pigeon. My dear little pigeon.
Transfigured.
Transfigured, yes. Renewed.
Polymorphed.
Polymorphed. We're not going to use the obvious one. But yes, I like that. And you'll be the singular pigeon, because I don't think there'd be any more than one pigeon who would listen to this, if any
pigeon
at all.
Only one pigeon would
make it. Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'd be ludicrous to think that pigeons would listen to this. So the only other option than one pigeon would be no pigeon, and therefore there'd be no point in the debate. So we therefore must have to conclude there is one pigeon listening to this at this moment, and has been listening to it for a while. Probably doesn't understand a word we're saying, which will mean our wait back for the information on Anthony Coburn might have a bit of time to wait on that. But who knows? Maybe it's quite a methodical pigeon and has learnt the ways of the internet.
Yeah, I think we should watch more of it. I think charmed by it would be the word I would use.
I kind of enjoy them for that. They're just gentle stories. You know, 25 minutes isn't too long.
Some might say it's almost the perfect amount of time for Magnus to sit and listen and watch a thing.
Almost as if it was pre-designed for you. Preordained.
Preordained.
Almost like your version of the ring, I guess, in a weird way. You'd be little Frodo in this example, I guess. Or Gollum,
so I was the wizard.
I suppose Gandalf carries it for a while, doesn't he?
He doesn't carry it at all, does he? He's got his own ring.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to touch it. So, no, I'd say in this analogy, you're kind of more of the Frodo, who has the ring, has almost been the legacy, as the final bearer.
He has to see it through to the end and watch every episode.
That is an entirely possible thing to do now, thanks to iPlayer. You could watch nearly all, apart from the missing episodes.
What's with the missing episodes?
They were episodes which were destroyed by the BBC back in the 70s, when they didn't quite realise that there was a sort of heritage to television that would be lost if they destroyed the originals and there was nothing left of them.
That's unfortunate. Were they just cleaning out the storage cupboards, being like, oh, we don't need this, we actually need the space?
Yeah, basically there was a
wild thing to think about.
And obviously it wasn't just Doctor Who, you know, there's many BBC, we'll call them heritage shows, you know, Blue Peter, Steptoe and Son, you know, so all lost in this in these sort of purges, because no one saw the benefit in this material.
That's the precursor to the tax write-off.
It is a bit. Because unknown to the BBC at the time, apparently these are actually worth quite a lot of money if you hold on to them. But yes, that's the start of Doctor Who. And that, as I say, is the first one with William Russell, who I still feel is one of the key catalysts of the show's success.
I have to catch up, do my homework.
Oh, don't do that. I never do that. Just grift it. Grift along.
I don't have the knowledge or the history to grift it.
Magnus, it's a pigeon. I doubt it's a very clever pigeon as well. It won't know. I mean, it's listening to this. It can't be that bright, can it? You've seen the quality of media out there, the quality of media available to human and pigeons that it could be listening to at this moment, that's listening to this. I don't think you have to worry about seeming intelligent.
Oh, I wasn't worried about that.
I'm on the topic of Doctor Who, not your intelligence generally, because by the name Magnus, it gives a suggestion of some mighty intelligence back there.
True.
You'd never give Magnus
Magnus the Time Lord does have a nice ring to it.
He does. It does sound very Time Lordy. It sounds quite pompous. I mean, Magnus in itself isn't pompous, but when attached to a Time Lord, it sounds like someone who could be quite pompous.
Aren't the Doctors kind of pompous?
William Hartnell certainly probably has a little bit of flair of pomposity to them. Anyway, so I think we'll probably leave that there. Again, get back to the run of doing some of the more recent stories. I'd say you've got three really interesting ones to watch.
That's what I meant by homework.
Yes, you do need to do that homework, I'm afraid. I think we'd be able to tell if you grift that one.
That's what I meant.
I see. Yes, I underestimated your intelligence, Magnus. But I will not overestimate the pigeons. Have a good evening.
Farewell, pigeons.
Pigeon.
Pigeon, bracket S.
You're just doing that to define me now.